Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
How is your Hanukkah? How is your Christmas? How is your Boxing Day? All of your holidays. I hope they are good. I hope they are fulfilling, or at the very least, less stressful than last year's holidays. Wish you all the best for a new year as well. I hope it exceeds all of your expectations. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Before the new year begins, we have this talk by David Perrin. This was recorded a few weeks back, actually. The week after Election Day, as I recall, November 15th, this was recorded live at our weekly Dharma gathering, and the topic is loving kindness. David Perrin, as you know, is a regular contributor to the podcast, and he is actually teaching our introductory meditation course called Meditation in Everyday Life. That's beginning Thursday evening, January 5th. It is a four-week course, 1 hour each weeknight for four successive Thursdays, beginning January 5th, Meditation in Everyday Life. By the end of that course, you should have all of the tools that you need to really hit the ground running to start your own independent, home-based meditation practice. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org and click the link on the homepage, Meditation in Everyday Life with David Perrin. And now, here's David Perrin to talk about loving kindness.
And I'd like to explore specifically loving kindness as an antidote to fear. So that's traditionally one of the ways that in the Buddhist teachings that loving kindness is talked about as an antidote to fear. So I want to explore that tonight because I know you're going to have some ideas. I'm going to share some things with you, and then we'll open it up and we can have a kind of discussion. And from your own questioning, your own experience, particularly valuable, the experience of this past week, right? This idea of loving kindness feels very hard to come by. On the one hand, and on the other hand, in moments it feels like it's essential and it's the key to moving forward. So let's consider that. So let's start with the latter part of that statement, loving kindness as an antidote to fear. Fear typically arises as this quality of being in response to otherness. Particularly otherness that has that is the unknown, right? So we have fears of being harmed. We have a fear of something coming through our bubble. We have a fear of death. So fear, you know, when the Buddha started teaching, the first teachings were around this idea of feeling destabilized. And he used the word suffering, but you could use lots of different words to describe that feeling of sometimes, often, what is the case of feeling fear. And the reason that he led off with that was the universality of it. Was if I just go and tell you, from his perspective, all these great practices to do and give you the teachings on, we could say, loving kindness, on the nature of mind, if we haven't begun to relate to just the nitty-gritty of our experience, then those things are not going to mean quite the same. So fear arises particularly, there's some examples of it. It arises particularly in response to instability. So that was another very basic teaching, that life is unstable in the sense that we never know what the next moment is going to bring. So we develop all sorts of constructs about the world and about ourselves, but no one here knows what's going to happen next. And we don't spend a lot of time pondering that, but it is actually the source of this ongoing trepidation that we feel. So immediately we can begin to understand fear as it has this quality of sensitivity to it, right? I mean, we have ourselves, we've come to know ourselves as this discrete entity that has a name. We have a family, we come from a lineage. We've learned certain things about ourselves. We have work that we do in the world. So there's a lot of ways in which we've formed this identity that is very useful in terms of putting one foot in front of the next. You know, before we start getting into deconstructing ego and, you know, where is the self, we can just talk about the idea that this self and our sense of self is there. And we rely on it every day. But because of that, because we have constructed that in order to get from one moment to the next and make one move and then connect the dots, there is this uneasiness rises because we don't know what the next moment is going to hold. We don't know what's going to happen to us. And so there's a sense that this, what we've created, is a little bit threatened. Either on a very subtle level that we're not particularly tuning into, except when we sit down to practice, or more overtly. And in reality, most of us, I'll speak for myself, that we have a fairly low tolerance for ambiguity. The other interesting thing about fear is that it doesn't act. Like if we were to almost anthropomorphize it, it doesn't act. And some people say, well, fear won the election. Well, I would take umbrage with that. I would not say that fear won the election. What happens is that fear creates a set of conditions. Realistically, fear, when people experience fear, there's not so much the sense of immediately, it's not acting, it's more cowering. It's more retreating and looking for refuge. I don't know if that's your experience, but that immediate quality of fear is like feeling destabilized, and then where do I go to, what do I do about that, right? It's this in-between flux state in which we're looking for something solid. So that's the condition that gets created, and out of that, the more active-oriented, what we would call the three poisons, or the destructive responses that come out of these destructive feelings of anger, so lashing out. So if I strike first, then I'm not going to be susceptible to whatever unknown is going to happen to me. Right, so anger or aversion, and then we have grasping or fixation. So I'm going to grasp onto if some idea, some person, some rhetoric that is going to offer me protection. And often we sacrifice either a small amount or a fair amount of our own autonomy in order to identify or be identified or feel like we are being protected by that thing or that person. And then, of course, there's one we're all familiar with, which is Netflix. Right? There's ignorance. There's sticking our head in the sand, pulling the covers over our head, few of us are immune from this response. It's a very natural place to go to when we feel threatened. All right, so that's like the bad news, right? Or that's the kind of, according to the teachings, that's a little bit the harsh reality of what we're working with. But it's important to understand that the mind, so the consciousness, the mind, the beingness that experiences this fear, we use the term basic goodness to describe that in Shambhala. So you could think of like an analogy would be DNA, right? So DNA combines to have all the different expressions in this room that we have. But what makes up DNA is basic goodness. It's the possibility of any particular potentiality or fruition. Another analogy for basic goodness would be that crystal ball up there. So that's we use this, and everything on this table is they're all reminders of our innate qualities. Nothing separate from us. There's nothing going on up here that is distinct from us. It's all completely, it's our mind. And so our mind has innate natural wisdom and clarity and a sense of strength and stability. And that ball, that crystal ball, right, it's completely clear. That's the basic goodness. But what would happen, right, if we were to slide a colored piece of paper behind the ball? It would appear to take on the color of that piece of paper, whether it was red or blue or orange or green. So in essence, this idea of neutrality, this idea of potentiality, it can hold anything. It is, on its own, also can have the expression, can be have this infusion of fear. And so that crystal ball also has the potentiality to lash out in anger, to grasp on and fixate. So there's almost, you can almost feel this relationship between wisdom and neurosis, right? There's a poem or a Rumi quote that's been going around a lot on social media that is something to the effect of there's a field beyond good and bad or good and evil. I'll meet you in that field. So this is pointing to this quality of basic goodness. It's a central part of these teachings, right? Is like how we begin to relate to something like fear from the mind of basic goodness, rather than going into the situation saying, I'm fundamentally flawed, that person is fundamentally flawed, that person is fundamentally evil. The teachings say that this is the mind that every sentient being shares. And confusion arises. And it's particularly palpable when fear is involved, because then it intensifies the choices. Fear intensifies the choices. So I have kids, and my 5-year-old daughter recently, I couldn't believe this because I didn't have a cavity till I was like 37 or something like that. But she had a cavity, she's 5, she had her first cavity. I think in her baby tooth, so I think that means that she'll grow back a fresh tooth, is that? Yeah. I don't know, she started complaining of this thing, and it was like, and then my partner Ann and I were like, oh God, I think, you know, and then we looked in there, we could see it, and then it's, oh, okay, we gotta call the, gotta go to the dentist. So let's think about a cavity and what happens in our body. Right? So there's a natural kind of homeostasis in the body. We have the enamel of the tooth that's protecting the tooth and the minerality of the tooth. And then we have plaque. And we have the bacteria that come from the foods we eat and sugar and all the rest of the stuff that your dentist has been telling you since you were 5 or younger. And so the actually there are enzymes in the saliva that help to protect, to rebuild that enamel. So when the acid is pounding away on the enamel of the tooth, there's also a regeneration that's happening at the very same time. Now, since I was a kid, I was told that fluoride was really good for teeth. Nowadays, the verdict is out a little bit, right? That fluoride, particularly synthesized fluoride, is basically a drug. And there's many people now saying it shouldn't be in drinking water and it has harmful effects. For the purposes of this analogy, I need you to think that fluoride's a good thing. Okay? So fluoride and the enzymes of our mouth are protecting the enamel of the teeth. But the bacteria, if it begins and the plaque, it begins to win over, it starts to extract the minerals out of the teeth and it creates a little hole and then, right, the cavity starts to build. So loving kindness is the fluoride of our practice. It's sort of what I would propose to us tonight is this idea that, you know, even in doing the and we're going to talk about what exactly loving kindness practice is in a moment. But even in doing our concentration practice, our mindfulness practice, we have a sense of settling and we have a sense of, you know, what it means to come back to the breath. And we have scary thoughts and we have neutral thoughts and we have seductive thoughts. And we have this relationship, okay, I can come back to the breath. And I have a choice of whether to follow those things or not. So that sense of stabilizing and that sense of finding some ground is really important, both for loving kindness practice, but just for like the feeling of I'm not going to freak out generally. Now, it's said in the tradition that there's like a healthy fear and an unreasonable fear. It makes this distinction. And healthy fear is the fear that basically promotes or moves us into some sort of positive action. So, right, the healthy fear of cavities gets us to brush our teeth so we don't have a situation where the plaque is starting to eat away and create this hole. A healthy sense of fear is something that is really actually potentially a threat, and we take some course of action to begin to address what that threat is. On the other hand, we have unreasonable fear, which often manifests as anxiety, like a low-grade anxiety or phobia. You know, so I'm afraid of the dark, or I'm afraid of spiders, or I have a kind of fear, you know, that I won't, my kid, something's going to happen to my kid if I just walk down the sidewalk, like someone's going to hurt them, or there's a car that's going to run on the sidewalk, so I just, you know, I get paralyzed and I don't even take them outside. And these are the kind of fear, they are often generated by stories that we begin to build up in our mind that take on a certain momentum, and then they color everything, that all of our perspective. But they're not necessarily rooted in a direct situation of being threatened by something. Now, there are many people at this point in this country, on both sides of this situation, that feel threatened and may have good and may well have good cause to feel threatened. So, loving kindness practice at its core, what is it? Those of you who've done it, what is it? Wishing people well. Yes, thank you. Any other? Yes, so starting with someone close to you and moving further and further out, all the way to strangers. And that's the traditional trajectory or progression of metta practice, which is what loving kindness translates from, metta practice.
Wishing
wishing to reduce suffering. So an idea of there's a compassion quality to it, which is what karuna is, compassion. Yes?
We don't really care about other people, so we change that direction to have it encompass everybody rather than just have it go in one direction.
Very good, yes. Yeah, so a sense of, I would say, equanimity, right? That instead of being in this polarity of good things to people we like and bad or indifferent to people that we don't like, we actually widen the lens a bit. Our habit or
habit of doing that.
Absolutely our habit of expressing those preferences, and that goes back to what I was saying in the very beginning of it, which is what feels like a very natural response to instability, right? Because if good things happen to people that I care about, then I don't have to worry about them. They're going to be taken care of. They're safe. Then they're available for me, and everything is okay. And then if the bad people would just, like, I don't even have to worry, and actually if they just go away, that's even better for me. Yeah, right, which would be this quality of just expunging them out of the system, you know, which, right, so we're beginning to describe the what's going on, not just in this country, but across the globe. Right. Yes?
I don't believe anyone's mentioned that it usually starts with yourself.
Yes. So it begins, right, so it begins with ourselves, right? It begins with this very basic step of appreciating our own humanity, right? Liking ourselves, being able to extend loving kindness towards ourselves, which I think traditionally, so thank you. That, starting from that place and then beginning to relate to the idea that happiness, the same happiness that we want, is the happiness that everybody else, every other sentient being on this planet wants. It's easier to wish it for everyone else if you can make a relationship to yourself and then begin to even fathom that, oh, that person on television there has that same basic, you could say, desire, wish, aspiration. So this is important moment. I want to actually take a second to, or take a minute or two to actually practice this with you and then see what your response is, right? Because there are three components to this practice that are important to remember. The first is, the foundation of this is our concentration practice, right? It is our shamatha practice known as peaceful abiding. So we need to begin, we need to settle the mind and body a little bit in order to not be so distracted or so easily succumb to our own fantasies and discursive thoughts that we can't even do the practice. Okay, so that's important to remember, that doing, taking a moment to settle and do your concentration practice. The second component of this is what we would call contemplation. So this idea we were just talking about, what is happiness for me? Where do I experience myself as being happy? And then can I begin to even visualize in my mind, can I even contemplate, like instead of being in that mind of good for me, bad for everyone else, can I even begin to wrap my mind around the fact that other people would want to be happy? And not just other people, but every single person and every single sentient being. So we need to actually visualize that. We need to visualize it for ourselves. And in the visualization contemplation, we not only, we actually have an embodied, I feel like it's important to have an embodied experience of that happiness, an embodied experience of what this, who this other is. And then the third component is the sending quality. So distinct from the concentration practice that most of us were probably doing at the beginning of this evening, now we're sending something out. We're sending it out. We're giving it. We're sharing it. We're sharing it. And so this is actually a generosity practice. It's a generosity practice. So in a time where our mind finds it most difficult to fathom being generous, this practice asks us to focus on doing that. And for that to be kind of the thrust, so rather than the energy coming back to the breath, the energy is I'm going to keep going out. I'm going to keep going out. Oh, I want to start thinking about myself and what I'm going to do later. Okay, no, come keep going back out. Back out to this person. So what are your reflections or your questions?
I'm not ready to send love out across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't do it right now.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yes. Can I ask how it was in the first part of it when it was directed towards when we were relating to that own feeling within ourselves of being in that place and then to a loved one?
That was easier.
Okay.
I was able to go that far, but
mm-hmm.
I kept on being blocked once you extended it further out.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Anyone else share that feeling? Yeah. Others? Yes. So, we have to start, right? It's just like our practice. We have to start one breath at a time. Yes.
Similar experience, but extending it out further, you know, I made the effort and it felt a little shaky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I felt shaky, like what's going to happen to me? You know, it's like it's all going out there.
Yeah.
What's left?
Yeah, really good question. What do you think? What might be your guess of what might be left?
Well, I mean, there's the idea of basic goodness, I guess. But right now, it's an intellectual concept. I mean, it's. I mean, sometimes I feel it, but I mean, right now, that's when I felt that it was like a concept, and it just felt like an emptiness. But I know it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think, you know, so I really relate to this idea of the uneasiness or you described it as
shakiness.
Feeling shaky.
Yeah.
Feeling shaky. So that, to some degree, that's a harbinger of really beginning to become in contact with something that is outside the bounds of what our concept of ourselves is.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to say is it's like the analogy to me is like working out physically. I mean, you know, being at your edge and kind of, you know, it's about what you can do.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Yeah, and that, right, and at that edge, it's kind of like, yeah. Oh, if I go too far, right. Maybe I'll tear a muscle or
right,
something
right.
bad could happen, but to be right. that, yeah. And that, so in our tradition, we talk about warriorship, and that's actually really the definition of warriorship. So it's victory over aggression. So warriorship is not, it's kind of like flipping the notion of traditionally what a warrior or a soldier would be. Yeah. We don't use actually soldier has nothing to do with it. It's warriorship. But sometimes we think of soldier and might and aggression, and we just flip that in this tradition. We talk about the bravery and courage to be in that place where we feel like we might get hurt, you know, and how do we go on from there? Or how do we stay with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's challenging.
Yeah, thank you.
I would like to make a comment that what we're doing, the practice, where we have to send peace and love, when I had my hands crossed like this way,
uh-huh.
I start feeling, especially my upper body, very, very relaxed and completely loose. But especially when I was sending peace and love to the person that I had in mind.
Yeah.
And that feels really, really amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So the sense of looseness and relaxation that comes from doing this practice, right? We begin to have the quality of it being an antidote to fear because we're generating something that then we're sharing. And it's not only generating for ourselves, but then we're sharing it out, which to some degree, you know, it builds it. It enhances it. Thank you. Right here in front.
I didn't have a problem intellectually to wish happiness for people I didn't know. Uh-huh. But there was a real qualitative difference in what I felt wishing happiness to someone I love, which was a warm feeling in the heart. And the other one felt just watching TV, like fake.
Yes.
It didn't have like a real feeling.
Yes. Yeah, so very well said. So the traditional progression, we did a little bit non-traditionally because we were doing a condensed time. Traditionally, it starts with oneself. It goes to actually it goes to more of a mentor or a teacher is the next one after that. Beloved person or loved one is actually third. So we sort of skipped the mentor, teacher. We had beloved. And then the fourth is the neutral person that we did. And then the fifth is what's described as the enemy. But that really is just connoting someone we're having a difficult time with, who we're really struggling with. And often in all of these cases, it's recommended to do someone who with whom you have a living relationship to. So even if you're not in active contact with your mentor or you don't have a one-on-one thing going, if they're alive, it helps. And if it's someone you're struggling with who you have some issue with rather than someone who's way far out there, it also helps because it helps your visualization to begin to imagine, well, like, what is it that's what's juicing me about this person? It also is with the difficult person, you don't have to go to the person that you most have the hardest time in the world with. You know, that's, don't take that on in the beginning of the practice. After we do all those people, we have the collective, right? So putting all those people together in one space, and that's the equanimity, that's the equality amongst all of them. So we're not giving more to the beloved and less to the person that we're having a hard time with, but we're really generating a sense of equanimity or equality amongst all of them. And then from there, we can begin to extend out the people in this room, the people in Chelsea, the people in New York City. And as it gets more broad, it gets a little bit daunting. I don't know if I can do that. It's how do I do that for all those people? We start with the people with whom it's a little bit easier. And there's a quality of a little bit of like fake it till we make it, right? So if we just have this sort of, okay, I'm sending, but I don't have much feeling for this person and I don't really feel like I'm really invested in them having love and happiness, we don't have to have a profound experience of really wishing them all this warmth and glowing. We can just, that's like the discipline of meditation of coming back to the breath. This is sending out even when it just feels sort of flat. But we keep doing it. Good question.
So I'm thinking to myself that I'm not really necessarily sending anything out into the world, because that doesn't seem physically possible.
Uh-huh.
It's more like I'm sending something to the world inside of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, what makes sense to me is that I'm not necessarily sending love to this person, but to the way that I understand them.
Yes.
And so in a sense, it's like I'm really sending love to myself in all aspects of the practice,
mm-hmm,
through exploring that. Could you talk on that like a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely an inseparability of ourselves and these objects of meditation. And I tend to believe that, you know, because of this idea of this inseparability or interdependence between them and me, like that there's not such a discrete boundary, that thoughts that are conveyed, even if they are to a projected object, there's still a conveyance, right? There's still something that's being set out there. When we set an intention, that intention affects other people. So if I got up here and I was trying to whip up everybody into like that we're all in danger and we need to lash out against certain people, I would be, that intention and how it gets carried out would be influential on others. Now, that is conveyed both through my speech and the action of my speech and related, but it also has to do with just what I'm thinking, on the level of thinking. You know, so when we set intentions, they're powerful and they can have powerful reverberations or effects, But it's true that there's that it's not actually like, you know, there is this distinct entity out there that is not part of me. I mean, we are, those two things are interrelated in that way. And then you start to get into the teachings on interdependence and emptiness and inseparability. And how is our mind connected to the mind of everybody else in this space? So I think this is like an interesting practice to begin to notice that in a way, and you're almost kind of practicing interdependence by acknowledging that. So yeah, good question.
I actually find this particular meditation really frustrating. Like,
yeah.
When we open with our 25-minute sitting practice, I find it really enjoyable and refreshing coming in from the day and sort of catching your breath and getting present with the room. But the loving kindness is the most frustrating part of it for me, is that when it comes to, we start off with the self, you know, mm-hmm. manifesting loving kindness for yourself, it just goes completely blank, like totally static.
Yeah.
You know, like trying to throw pebbles through a window and it's just hitting a closed window frame. And when you mention the neutral person, I have a very easy time bringing a person to mind and really recognizing their common struggle and common humanity and vividly wishing them well. And then for someone I care about, it's even easier. But the frustrating part is, you know, piggybacking off fear is, you know, why can't I manifest it for myself?
Yeah.
And what does that really say about me?
Yeah.
And then I start to think about things I've heard about different practices that are good for you and that I can't grasp and that I'll never be able to. It actually becomes kind of a very fearful process in and of itself.
Yes. Yes, thank you for bringing that up. And that's, I know you're not alone in experiencing that. I have a question. When we did the visualization at the very beginning, where I was asking you to think of that place or scenario where you have the sense of comfort and security and safety, was there something that came to mind for you?
I don't want to turn this into therapy.
No, I'm just curious.
I mean, I always picture myself on a beach because I feel good there.
Okay. And what was the felt? So, and then when I was asking you to kind of like feel that in the body, what was this experience there? Was that, did it feel difficult or?
No, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's more, you know, the idea of loving kindness, love mm-hmm. and kindness
yep.
towards oneself. I just find, you know, maybe I have an idea of what it should feel like, and since I'm not achieving that, I think I'm doing it wrong.
I think that's sort of getting at it a little bit, is this idea of there's something that I'm not doing right in order for this to happen. But when I asked you where you feel comfortable and you were on a beach, that was an act of loving kindness that you generated toward yourself.
Right.
So see, when I present this, I don't want to say it's a trick a little bit, but I kind of tricked you in a way because I had you create a scenario with which you were providing yourself, because that visualization, you generated that love and kindness for yourself. You put yourself in that place. All I did was ask you to do that, and then you put yourself in a place where, okay, I feel some sense of peace. Mm-hmm. So that, and notice that we didn't do the sending towards ourself, right? We felt that place, and then the next thing we did was extend it towards this beloved person. But you had already created that situation and given yourself that gift. When I do this, sometimes what I do is after the beloved person, I'll come back to the self and have us really send that feeling to ourselves. But I think it really starts with, it can start with giving yourself the gift of imagining I'm in this place where I feel protected, I feel a sense of love, I feel a sense of care, maybe someone else has extended that care to me, or it's just like, I can actually really relax here. The feeling of that begins to get into what the loving kindness is, I think. So practice with that a little bit, and yeah, I think you're already on the way of like, maybe this is not what I think it is, or maybe it's, maybe a better way of saying it, I don't know how to say this exactly, but maybe it's the failure or the fear of failure is the exact, that's exactly what needs to be put in the cradle. We call it the cradle of loving kindness. So the beach chair of loving kindness, right? So that, that fear that I'm not doing it right, I'm not getting it right, I'm not going to ever be able to do that, go to the beach chair. Okay?
Thanks.
You're welcome. So I think that was a great last question, because I really encourage you all to hold yourselves in the cradle of loving kindness. Use that as your base. And the one thing that we didn't really talk about, but I want you to take forward now, is the idea that out of this space, what we create is a sense of really sharpening our highest knowing, our wisdom and intuition. So rather than losing something by sending out, or rather than feeling like, oh, you know, I'm not going out and acting in the world, this practice helps create the conditions to know how to act and how to move forward. We call that prajna, or highest knowing. So this is a practice of generating prajna. Okay, so not only are we benefiting ourselves and others, we're also creating prajna, and we know how to engage in our world, and we don't feel like we're at the whim or mercy of things that feel totally out of our control. So that's a bit of the possibility that lies ahead. Good luck with your practice, and hope to see you around soon. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Did you know you can email us? It's true. podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, wishes, hopes, dreams, recipes, whatever you got. podcast@shambhalanyc.org. As always, you can visit our website at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. If you are in the New York City area, come visit us. Come see these talks live and in person every Tuesday night at our weekly Dharma gathering. That's every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York on West 22nd Street in the heart of Chelsea, Manhattan.